If you want a little show and you don't know where to go, put on your headphones and hit the mark.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. Hit the Mark, Mark Levy. This is your host, Mark Levy. And for those that are not in this room, that is the second time I've tried the opening today. 186 times I've done that opening, guys, and I fucked it up for the first time ever. Nah, it's fine. You guys don't know about it. And if I didn't bring knowledge to it, only two people in the world will have known about it. It's fine. It's cool. I'm okay with it. This is not a perfect podcast. If you want a perfect podcast, I'd say Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is pretty much as close to perfect as a podcast can. Maybe This American Life, but I feel like Bullseye does a lot more to it instead of This American Life. But although I like This American Life better, that doesn't matter. guys, this is a fun day. It's a snow day. This is not airing on Monday. This is airing on Monday. We're not recording on Monday. My gosh, this is going to be a scatterbrained episode. And I'm in love with it already. That's all cool. But, you know, it's all exciting. It's a snowy day. You know, things are in the air. Things are getting cluttered. It's all good. Of course, you know, there's so many ways to support the show. If you go to iTunes, you can rate us, review us. 5 stars if you'd like. Today's 5-star poll quote thing, if you want to get a free t-shirt. Still no one has done it. Although Mike Luciano was really close to getting it right. Mike, what you did wrong was you wrote better than the Beatles, but you didn't write it in the comment part. You just wrote it as the headline. So this is what I need you guys to do. Just for this one, you're like, I love listening to Hit the Mark, especially on snow days. And then like just give like a write thumbs up inside the actual description. If you write that, take a photo of it, take a photo of you, give me a thumbs up, send it to hchampod@gmail.com, you will get yourself a free Hit the Mark t-shirt. Mike Luciano, you were really, really close to getting, like, so close. I was like, I even remembered when I wrote, said, better than the Beatles. If you think this podcast is better than the Beatles, you know what, you guys are awesome. I will say that. And thank you for the review also, Mike. Of course, you can go to Zazzle, you can rate us, review. You can go buy shirts, hats, mugs, all that great stuff. It's all there. And of course, you know, if you go to hitthemark.podomatic.com, you will see a PayPal button there. And you can donate as much or as little money as you want. It's a free podcast. It'll always be free. 186 episodes are free. And I'm very happy about that. Plus the bonus ones. Today's guest, Nat Towson, we'll be talking very, very shortly. Before I get there, I want to do a quick TV show review. Yeah, I rarely do TV show reviews, but this one I felt like I should. The Last Man on Earth. It's a show that I've heard of for a while now. It was really mysterious when, like, all the promotions of it, and it's pretty much exactly what I wanted it to be. That's the easiest way to put it. Will Forte is the last man on Earth, and the first, like, 20 minutes of the pilot is almost no talking. It's just him, like, being alone and, like, doing what you would do if you were all by yourself on Earth. Like, he steals, like, the mat from the White House that says, like, the Oval Office, like, with the presidential seal. He has, like, all these great pieces of art, all that great stuff. And then, like, you know, it's just him, like, slowly going crazy because he's the only man alive. It's brilliant. It's also done by the people that do the Lego Movie and Clash of the Chance Meatballs. By the time this airs, 3 episodes will have aired. And I hope the third one is as good as the first two because they are fantastic. This is a very funny, very smart show. I don't want to ruin much more because it's good to have mystery in shows. But see it. It's really funny. And Will Forte is very underrated. I will say that. It totally hits the mark. All right, so today's guest, I am very excited to have him on the show. A new friend of mine, we met like a month and a half ago, probably, yeah. He writes for Vice, he writes for College Humor. He's been called a very bright young man by Mr. Bill Gates. He is the host of Nat Towson's Downtown Variety Hour, the one, the only Nat Towson. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this. Thanks for coming out on this very picturesque day.
No problem.
Yeah. So, yeah. Let's just, like, yeah. Like, how have you been since Monday?
How have I been since Monday?
Yeah, no, it was last time I saw you. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. good. I haven't done any. I had my monthly show at UCB East, so I actually have not done any shows in the past 2 days, which I normally don't like to lapse more than a day without any shows, but I was exhausted on Tuesday and had a project to finish on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of writing to do. So I'm kind of, like, now emerging from a brief hermit phase.
It's always good, though, to do that, though. Like, to go, like, in a hermit phase, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, recently I've been getting 2 days off in a row at work.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, one day I basically just sleep. The other day I just do a million things. Yesterday was my sleep day. Today is the day I'm doing, like, 1,005 things, so.
Yeah, I can't do really... I've always, like, when I... If I stop... Like, sometimes it's important just to take a day off and not do anything even creatively.
Yeah.
And so if I do that, I feel like day one feels good. I'm like, I have all this time. I want to read a book or just do whatever I want. I watch TV. And then the second day, I'm trying to, like, kind of trying to have the fun I had on the first day. And then by day three, I get stir crazy. And
yeah.
I have to, like, go back to at least making something.
Yeah.
So I try not to do that too much. So, but essentially, yeah. Tuesday was it wasn't a total day off, but it was like a half day for me. Yeah.
And plus it was like rainy and stuff like that, so.
Yeah. I sort of used it as an opportunity. And I didn't have any shows booked. I was just going to do mics, so
that's nice.
I just didn't do anything over the past couple of days, and I just sort of stayed in and wrote for a while.
Yeah. So I have a weird question, because I never noticed the Bill Gates thing before.
Oh, yeah.
How did that happen? How did Bill Gates call you a bright young man? I mean, you are a smart man.
Thanks. I was younger at the time. I was in the fourth grade on the TV show. I don't know if you'll remember this, but it was called Nick News. It was on Nickelodeon.
Yes, with Linda Ellerbee.
Yes, and I interviewed, I was part of a panel or a group discussion with Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And... it's a thing he said to me in person.
Yeah.
And I specify that because I was edited entirely out of the episode.
You see
me reacting to things, but the whole thing, it was this must have been 1994, I want to say. And so the internet, AOL, the World Wide Web was relatively new.
Yeah,
I had had it from the beginning.
Yeah, same here. My parents were early adopters.
Right. So I knew a lot, and I knew a lot about computers and that culture, too. I knew who Bill Gates was, and I knew of his reputation before the internet had become a big thing, or before the World Wide Web, I should say. The internet had been a thing for a while.
Right.
And I was asking questions like, do you see the internet as a platform for education? Could disabled students theoretically like telecommute to school? Are we going to decentralize education in that way?
Oh my god.
I asked him, I was like, hey, didn't you once say that Windows were for wimps and then you invented the Windows software? And
this is why you write for Vice.
Yeah, so he answered this question. Yeah. And I remember him saying, he's like, well, yes, when, we were used to using the command line, so yes, at first, Windows did seem kind of wimpy. And, like, he did cop to it, being called on the, I was nine, and so I'm asking all these questions, and it was me, and there was a girl who was the grade below me at my school, and then kids from other schools.
Yeah.
And the grade below me had done this project where they created, like, a newsletter with a school in Australia, and they were, communicating with a third grade class in another continent, which was really cool. And so she was asking questions that were pretty smart, too. And I remember the producers took her aside, and they, like, did a reshoot at the end, and they had her ask, what is email? And she, I think, was pissed off about this.
Because that's, like, such a dumb question.
Yeah. And we were, like, 8 and 9, but I think we were smart kids. And they just wanted it to be so entry-level that I don't know if she got another question in other than the one that they propped her up and made her say. And I got cut out entirely. I must have asked 5 or 6 questions.
Were you, like, was it the one time you ever appeared in Nick News, or...?
Yeah, they never asked me back.
Like, this kid's too good.
It was not. I was clearly not what they wanted. I had auditioned for it, and they had interviewed me, and they thought I was good for it. And then, I don't know. I mean, those are the two questions I remember asking. I know I asked 5 or 6 questions. I was very prepared, and I guess they didn't vet me beforehand to ask what the questions I was going to ask were.
I just imagine you were in a suit also, because, like, that's, like, pretty much how I always imagine.
That's really funny. No, that didn't start until much later. I think I was averse to wearing button-down shirts until high school at the very earliest. As a kid, I was very much, like...
casual.
I just comfortable. Yeah. I wore sweatpants all the time. I'm real popular, I'm sure you could tell.
He's got wet pants right now, yeah.
I am wearing lined pants from L.L. Bean.
Oh, my God.
Because it is cold outside, and I wasn't too worried about impressing you with my pants.
That's cool, man. I mean, I'm always impressed, so...
So, yeah, they never asked me back on Nick News.
Like, that show...
That was my one episode, and I'm not in it speaking.
Nickelodeon scared me so much as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought I was going to get AIDS as a kid, because the artists that did all the art for Nickelodeon when we were kids...
Like Keith Haring?
Yeah. Because, like, they kept... I remember there was, like 2 or 3 weeks when I was a kid, where they just were like, AIDS, and I'm like, waiting to watch Hey Dude, and hearing about AIDS.
Yeah, there were a lot of PSAs in like the mid-90s on Nickelodeon, they were...
Yeah, especially because like Nick News was like a huge thing for them.
Keith Haring lived in my neighborhood. He was over on, well, the Pop Shop was over on Crosby Street.
Right, right, you're from Lower Manhattan, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in the Bowery, so...
So you were always at CBGB's as a kid.
I grew up on that block, actually.
Are you serious?
Yeah, Hilly Crystal, the owner, and his son Dana lived in my building.
That's so cool.
It used to be the only building on that side of the block. Now there's a giant NYU dorm there, and there's something on the other side, too. I don't remember what, but for years you could go, and it was just this one lone building in the center of the block, and that was my building.
That's like such a weird, like New York-y, like the apartment type situation. There.
Well, it was just like, I mean, in the 80s, and this was sort of the tail end of it, but like that neighborhood was still poor. And so, you know, you could have, there were just lots on either side of my building. Like now the idea of an abandoned lot in the Lower East Side is unheard of because it was such valuable real estate. But then it was just like, it wasn't worth the money to rebuild on at the time. So there were like two on either side. I think they were just sort of used as parking lots for a while.
Right.
Mostly people were squatting there a lot of people were squatting on at least one of them. And I think one got converted into, just like rental parking spaces or stuff like that. But like the idea of having that now is insane.
It's hard enough to find parking. Like, I mean, parking lots in the city are like always like leaving us like from the chain parking lots.
Oh, yeah.
Like there, I saw, like, I used to go sometimes to see Shakespeare in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had a couple friends and a couple productions are there. And like, they're like, it's our last season because this parking lot's becoming like a building.
Right, yeah.
And
much more profitable.
That's like the only parking lot, like in that part of Lower East Side, I feel like, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, but I feel like it is. Like, it's around the Delancey area, so.
Yeah, I mean, they've pretty much all disappeared at this point.
I mean, I really do wonder what would have been like if I, like, because my parents are from New York. They met in Miami, but, like, mm-hmm. I do wonder what would have been like if I grew up in New York.
How long have you been here?
I've been here for almost 6 years, so.
Oh, right. We were talking about this the other day.
Yeah.
You're about 5 years at UCB.
Yeah. Actually, by the time I'm serious, I will be at 5 years.
Hey. Congratulations.
Yeah. John Gambris 101, baby.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Best 101 teacher in the world.
He's awesome. I love that guy. Yeah. He's a...
He's killing it right now.
He's such a strange phenomenon. I remember I saw him tell a story at Nights of Our Lives about... And basically describing himself as this totally unself-aware bro in college... And I remember we told the story, but he told it with such an awareness and like such a different persona. I mean, he is still kind of that like fun energy party guy.
He's a giant big dude.
But he has so much like intelligence and self-awareness that I remember we walked away from that show and a friend of mine was like, I always thought that if you made it through college being that kind of person, that was it. That you were locked in. Because he basically, like, he's telling this story from, like...
I mean, he's a rugby guy. He's a rugby, which is, like, a very cliche thing.
But the story he was telling, he was just being such a, like, misogynist bro, like, who thinks he's so cool. But he's telling the story, like, can you believe how cool I thought I was? And I remember my friend was like, I really thought that... If you made it to 21 and you were still like that, there was never going to be that folding in. You were never going to become self-aware. But somewhere along the way, he became this like really awesome, self-aware, like kind person. Yeah.
And now he's like killing it with Comedy Bang Bang and every other thing that he's doing out in LA.
Hair Jacked. You know about Hair Jacked?
No, I don't know anything about Hair Jacked.
It's like, I think it's on its second season now.
It's
it
like
is an
MTV
ambush
or...
prank show that takes place in a hair salon, I think. And they give people, like, he did a pilot and then they ordered like 24 episodes of it or something like that.
It's like the...
I've never seen it, but I was talking to someone else about this the other day.
Is he on it?
Who, John? Gamers? He's the host.
So it's like that, like the live, like the school club thing that he did.
Yeah, he's like...
I watched every episode of that too, because the guy's the best. I didn't know he hosts.
Well, it's the funny thing is, like, he's bro-y enough that MTV or Spike or places like that, I think Herjack might be on Spike. He's like that has that persona enough that people who watch Spike will be like, oh, that's a cool guy who I could be like, but he's also self-aware and kind enough to actually be funny, where a guy who's actually like that, if you gave him a show, would just be an asshole to
like,
people.
Yeah, side mohawk, brah.
Yeah, and so he is actually, like, yeah, a funny person because he has some degree of compassion and self-awareness, and so that makes him perfect for these shows, though, where it's like, in your face, you know, he's on Wildin' Out for a while, like, it's bizarre, but, like, he's, like, that middle ground really works for him.
Yeah. And, well, you and me are on the other side of the spectrum, where we're just nerdy guys. But in a cool
way.
Not
the angle I'm working. His angle is not the angle I'm working, I'll tell you that much.
I mean, I could probably pull it off, but I'm way too neurotic to pull it off, so.
Yeah, and you might have to lose the glasses or trim the beard or something.
I don't
know about trim the beard, actually. I take that back.
I actually want to trim the beard, like, really badly, just because it's, like, really, really unwieldy long right now.
Well, it's within your, it's within your realm of control.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. It's just, right now, I'm just, like, I don't know, like, things are weird with the beard, because people are, like, really digging the beard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, should I just, like, never shave again?
Well, the good news is you can always grow it back.
Yes, I can. I mean, unlike other hair on other places, my body, unfortunately, I can't grow.
I had very long hair for a while, and that was, like, a paranoia of mine. It's like, people like my long hair. People comment on it all the time. I don't know if I really externalized, will they still like me if I cut my hair? But it was, like, fucking desperate for attention. Girls talking about my hair. I can't cut my hair. And then, you know, I cut it, and I looked way better, and everyone talked about how good my hair looked short, and, you know, that was fine. So, it's largely in your head.
I mean, I'm fine with whatever. I mean, I'm a character actor. If I'm not okay with what I have, then what am I going to be okay with?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but, like,
I won't destroy you to shave your beard.
Let's put it this way, guys. You can see me with a fantasy version of this beard on June 12th on Netflix.
Hey, all right.
Starting June 12th on Netflix.
What does that mean, fantasy version?
Like, a really long version of my beard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like,
for what?
I don't know if I want to announce it.
People know.
People know what it is.
All right, but, like, we won't say it on
Netflix. I mean, it's not, like, it's not that huge of a deal, but it's...
No, I didn't realize it was unannounced. Sorry.
It's fine. I mean, I'll tell you later if you want.
Sure.
It's not that... It's really not the big deal. I don't want to just be like, hey, guess what? I want people might be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Let's, like, dive in. Like, fully dive in.
Where
all right, so, Nat, what was, like, your big comedy or writing or acting inspirations growing up?
As, like, a kid?
Yeah.
That's hard to pinpoint. My parents were both clowns.
Really?
Yeah, they started the New York Clown Theater Festival. It was, like, not...
They started it?
Yeah. Wow. With a few other people. Okay. And, they... You know, people imagine circus clowns, but it's more like an amped up sketch, the kind of stuff they do. It's all in theaters and stuff like that. But with, like,
it's more mime comedy. Clown instead of circus clown.
Well, not necessarily. Well, yeah, I mean, it's verbal, so it's not mime. But right. but yes, in that it's pantomime, physicality,
exactly,
and that kind of thing. And so, you know, it's like sketch if everyone had, like, sort of bigger characters, and also there was a larger conscious physical comedy element to everything. And so, I mean, there's that, but it was basically everyone I knew as a very young child, everyone I knew was a performer of stuff, if not a comedian of some sort, or, you know, a comedic performer of some sort, they were a performer, a dancer,
right,
or something like that. So that was, like, it's always just been a thing that you do. Everyone I knew put on shows. When I was a kid, we put on shows. The earliest thing is just, like, I was constantly going to shows even before I can really remember, and sitting in, you know... I would be, like, 2 or 3, and my parents would have a rehearsal, and they'd be like, all right, put them in the corner of the loft. We had a loft down on Chambers Street,
right.
But back before that was an incredibly expensive thing to have. And so I would just sit in the corner and, like, play with a... I had, like, 3 toys at this loft and watch people rehearse. So, I mean, that's, like, it. I can't remember a time before that, but, like, the earliest things I was into, you know, my dad is probably a big... student of comedy in a lot of ways, so he had VHS tape after VHS tape of Looney Tunes cartoons. So,
yeah.
So those are like, that's what I watched all the time.
Nice. Who's your favorite Looney Tune character?
Probably Daffy Duck.
Yeah.
Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny stuff was my favorite.
I always loved Taz.
Oh, yeah. I don't think my dad did, so I probably didn't have as much of that stuff. I think I had more of the Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Bugs Bunny stuff, and Elmer Fudd. And, I used to watch a lot of that, and then a lot of silent, like, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd films like that.
Charlie Chaplin, maybe?
Some Chaplin, less of that. My dad was really into Keaton.
Yeah,
I didn't have cable, I didn't watch a lot of TV, so pretty much my access was whatever my dad had on VHS tapes.
And, like, most people that are Keaton fans aren't Chaplin fans.
Yeah, not necessarily. He is into all that stuff. So now he's got every Chaplin movie on DVD, as well as every Keaton and Harry Langdon and Harold Lloyd. But at the time, I remember he had all these VHS tapes that would say, like, PC-1, PC-2, and it was physical comedy. And so it would be, like, a Buster Keaton short, a Bugs Bunny cartoon, a live performance that he'd seen somewhere, and he would just have these archived on, because, you know, this was what was available at the time, and so he would just have these tapes that were, like, physical comedy mixtapes, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would just watch those as a
kid.
That's
so cool.
Yeah, and that's like real. That's really early. And I remember in the third grade, my dad was like, "Go turn on the TV to Channel 5. And I was like, "Okay, why?" And he was in the other room. He said, "Just go do it." And I went and I turned it on, and The Simpsons was on, and I'd never seen The Simpsons before.
And that's like the appropriate age.
That was. I mean, it blew my mind. It was. I became obsessed within a week. And I'm sure he regretted it, because there was a solid 10 years where the only thing I would talk about was The Simpsons. But,
oh, you were that kid.
Well, but all my friends were like that.
Yeah,
that was the thing. Everyone I knew was like that. My brother and I mean, we joke about this, but we literally used to refer to time in relation to when The Simpsons was on TV. So it would be like 3 hours before The Simpsons, or 2 hours after, and that would change because from like season to season, it was like, oh, now it's on at 7:30 and not 7 o'clock.
Right.
The reruns were 5 days a week. That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
Because our parents would be like, well, maybe we could just talk over dinner. We were like, well, The Simpsons is on. You can talk during the commercials. Like for a very long time, they tried to stop.
They created monsters.
Well, they tried to like steer us away from that, and I think after a while they just gave up because we just wouldn't pay attention, or we just were so into it.
That's how I was with Saved by the Bell.
Oh, really?
But yeah, like I watched like every episode like pretty quickly, and then like they were on TBS like every day at like 3 p.m. or like 4 p.m. and I would always make sure I'm home for that.
Oh, yeah? And I never really watched that show.
I loved it.
Yeah, so that was like the big. And my dad didn't even really watch it. I remember I'd seen promos for it, but I was like, I didn't know what it was. Really.
So dad was like, maybe he'll like this.
And yeah, to this day, I'm not entirely sure, and I don't know if he really remember his motivation of something from, you know, 20 years ago or more. But he, I owe him big for that one, because that became the thing that shaped my sense of humor. And I think that was the first thing that was really mine, too. Even though he'd introduced me to it, he didn't really watch it like I did. Or he liked it enough, and he knew it was smart, and it was like witty, but it wasn't quite his thing. I mean, he's a physical comedy guy. He likes bigger stuff than that. I think The Simpsons is more my speed, which was like, you know, cutting and sarcastic, especially, you know, my speed in 1993. It was learning sarcasm as a way of sort of differentiating myself. And so that was like the first thing that was really my own, I think.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. That's really awesome there.
And then also, right around the same time, on Saturday morning cartoons, Animaniacs and Freakazoid started airing.
Oh, that was great.
And I rewatched the first few episodes of Freakazoid in the past year, and I remember they didn't know who they were marketing it towards originally, because eventually they moved it to 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, it'll be for older kids. But I remember watching the first episode, and I believe it aired at 8 a.m. on a Saturday.
Okay. And that sounds right, yeah.
It's insane, and it's so postmodern, and there's all these like layers upon layers, and he's narrating it, and it cuts out to the narrator. The narrator's a puppet, and he's puppeteering the narrator.
Oh my god!
And it's just, but I was, and it's so overstimulating. But I was like that as a
kid. Yeah,
And I also loved it because I was this like computer nerd who he is, but also this like manic child, and like both sides of those were in this show. This like dual identity of this character, right? And so I loved it. And I remember watching that first episode, and it was like being like so turned on, like my brain was overclocked watching it. And then the last thing that happens in the episode is the credits roll, and it like shows the Warner Brothers shield logo.
Yeah.
And then he runs, Freakazoid runs back in, like in front of the credits, like out of the reality, and it's just like, wake up your parents and tell them you're hungry, and then runs off screen. I was like, holy shit, what is this show doing? Like, you know, this was before every cartoon was, like, winking to the camera and everything, and I just remember, like, it was 8:30 in the morning, my parents were not awake yet, and it was just like, now wake up your parents! And, like, it was like they were just making kids as hyped up as possible, and eventually they figured out, like, maybe 8 a.m. was not the time for this, but I was right in the target demo when that
still
came out. But
11 a.m. is still wake up your parents.
Oh, yeah, for some kids. But both of those shows were so smart and funny.
Animaniacs is, like, still one of my favorite. Like, I remember when they came out on DVD the first season,
mm-hmm.
I think I was, like, in college, like, Dad and Peaky and the Brain came out and bought both, because they both mm-hmm. were amazing shows for me, like, growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I was really mad because I forgot that my favorite Animaniacs episode was not the first season.
Oh, really?
The Siskel and Ebert one.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, where they murder them both, which is really sad.
I kind of remember that, yeah.
Like, I remember they were pumping Ebert full of lard.
I kind of forgot about that episode.
But, like, yeah, because like, that was the same time I started, like, getting into, like, Siskel and Ebert. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, like, all that stuff happened in that episode. Like, this is weird, and just loved it.
Yeah, I mean, that's also, like, they were kind of continuing in the tradition of Looney Tunes. I don't think at the time I realized that there had been a decades-long gap between the two. But
and Tiny Toon Adventures was similar in vein, too.
It was around that time, but I don't know if I really watched that until later. But I remember it was like, that sort of tradition of... It was a Warner Brothers cartoons, and it was in that tradition, but it was really modern, like it fit the same format, but for the time, and in the way that the early Looney Tunes stuff was absurd and form breaking and genre parodying and all this stuff, they were doing the same thing. Like it would be set in a historical context, the text would be about Magellan, or it would be like a film noir parody or something like that. And I remember having a conversation with the co-host of my whole show, actually. We were talking about how insane it is that Looney Tunes held up so, like, they were made in the 40s, some of these, and like, most of the jokes hold up, like, you know, occasionally they'll be like
80% of them hold up.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally there'll be, like, a Humphrey Bogart or Peter Lorre impression that's, like, a little dated, and, like, people aren't really referencing that anymore, but they're, like,
canceled my Peter Lorre act,
But they...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but so, I mean, I don't think as a kid I realized that Animaniacs was that many decades really later than Looney Tunes.
Right, right.
But it, to me, that was kind of in the same vein. That was the kind of stuff that I was into.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So, what was, like, growing up in Manhattan?
Well, it was really different from how it is now.
Yeah.
I grew up on the Bowery and 2nd Street, which was not like a terribly poor neighborhood at the time, but it wasn't like...
It was a punk rock neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and there were winos on the street. I mean, there's a lot of homelessness. I think, you know, really early awareness of you know, if you grow up in a suburb where you could, and you drive to school, you might delay this realization, but I mean, I remember having conversations with my mom as a kid, you know, 3 or 4 years old. I mean, like, why is that guy on the street? And your parents have to explain something to you, you know, that you don't...
That conversation happened for me later, yeah.
Yeah, they don't give you the full breadth of the situation, but you know, I think a lot of it was realizing, I think I became politically aware much earlier on, and I don't know, it affects you in a lot of ways. So a lot of it was, I mean, homelessness was really big. You'd see trash can fires, tent cities, things like that. You know, when I was growing up, there was still, Tompkins Square Park was still tents. It was still a huge homeless population. There's the riots in 90 and 91, which, of course, you know, my parents mostly shielded me from knowing about, but...
As they should.
But, you know, but word would get around, and I had a buddy who lived in Alphabet City, which at the time was a place I wasn't allowed to go. Like,
really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember it, like, moving back after college, and first, like, I heard someone say, I got a new... Someone said they had a new apartment in Alphabet City, and the other one the other person said, oh, Alphabet City, nice. And then, oh my God, it's all over. Because that, to me, that was insane to me. Because, yeah, I wasn't allowed to go there.
And you now host a show in Alphabet City.
Yeah, we had to, I know, we had to, but I would have had to have an adult with me to go there as a kid, for sure. Tompkins Square Park was not a place we could be unsupervised. Washington Square Park, you could be, but the East Village, definitely not, no. I mean, especially not Alphabet City.
Well, this is a weird question, but, like, going back to the whole living on the same block as CBGBs, like, did you ever, like, run into, like, any, like, those, like, people, like punk rock icons that, like, performed there?
I mean, how would I have even known?
Well, that makes sense.
I did, well, actually, I did meet Patti Smith on a number of occasions.
That's cool.
But a little later, or maybe it was while still living there, I'm not sure, but her daughter went to my school, so she would, like...
So you would see her...
Just come and be a mom and pick up her kids, which is bizarre, but...
Because it's Patti Smith.
yeah, but, you know, who knows who I would have passed, but at age, you know, 6, I probably wasn't like, oh, is that Tom Verlaine?
Oh, look, Joey Ramone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Ramones practice space was, I think, across the street from me for a while, on, like, the second floor across the street. In,
right.
You know, who knows?
I don't.
Well, my aunt used to babysit me, and she claims to have seen him. I can't tell if her stories are, at this point, apocryphal or wishful thinking,
okay.
or if she did actually run into members of the Ramones.
Well, that happens.
So, I don't know.
So yeah. What were you like in high school?
Oh, man. I was figuring it out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's weird to say I was, like, a nerdy kid because I went to a specialized math and science school. So everyone was really, most people were, not everyone. Some people just did well at a test once. But it was a school where, like, the popular kids were also often the kids with the best grades. And not driven by the fact that they had the best grades. It was just like, you know, the captain of the football team was a candidate for valedictorian in my school. So things
were a
little
different.
Yeah,
that was not my school.
No, so I didn't have the typical high school. But, I mean, really, it's funny because I think I got there, I was like the best math student in my school, but my school had been so slow and moving at the speed of the slowest kid in the class that I got there and I was way behind on that stuff. And I really, high school is really where I figured out that, I was, because I was very strong academically up until then, and
yeah.
I think I had a hard time, some personal stuff happened to me that was rough, and I had a hard time recovering from that, plus the hard time from just catching up to where all the other students were at.
Right.
And I think that was where I really eventually, I mean, it took years, but figured out that I wanted to write and wanted to perform. And,
yeah.
Because, like I said, those were always, especially performing, it was just a thing that you did to
did
me.
Did you, like, start really young also? Like someone's when you saw, like, 15?
Oh, well, I was doing improv, earlier, 13 or 14, we had an improv group at my school, and you know, it was started by a couple of girls who had seen Whose Line, but I knew all these acting and theater games,
cause, right.
I mean, I was in plays in middle school, and probably even before then, you know, it's like, at what point do you start considering it legitimate, but I was doing plays and stuff in middle school, I was doing improv at, like, 13 and 14, and my school actually had a humor magazine. It was like an Onion clone. Like, it was big, like a fake newspaper.
Right.
It was called The Broken Escalator, which is, in retrospect, I think a Mitch Hedberg reference, which I don't think I even got at the time.
Was it, like, time appropriate for that?
It would have been, yeah. I think so.
I mean, that joke came out, like, in 2002.
Did it really?
Maybe
sure?
A little bit earlier.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Because I think it's like one of like the middle Hedberg jokes.
Yeah, because 2002 would have been around when I started working there, but I think it had been started a year or two earlier.
Okay.
So maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, also there were escalators in the school that, which was great, but they constantly would stop and stop
and
working.
And become stairs.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that
I was
reference.
A really big Mitch Hedberg fan. So, and I saw him like 8 months before he died. Sorry.
Oh, wow. I never actually got to see him live, unfortunately. Anyway, first couple of years I did improv and as like an extracurricular. That's where like a lot of my friends came from. And, I mean, I was on the football team my freshman year too.
What
like,
position?
I was the third string quarterback. And
nice.
Also, but what that meant was mostly I was a wide receiver or a cornerback because that was where there's actually time you could get on the field.
Right.
I would be quarterback for about 3 plays a game.
And that'd be like merely holding the football for the kicker.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, it's just like. No, because that would be a special team, so you wouldn't be able to
Get
involved with the kicker. That would be the hands team, which I was not on. But it's high school football, so you're not throwing the ball for the most part. So it would just be running plays. So
yeah.
You know, I'm small and quick, and I could do handoffs, but, like, I wasn't a great quarterback or anything. You know, of course not. So, I was tiny. Like, I hadn't even had a growth spurt yet. I was, like, the shortest person, and then I grew, like, 6 inches in a year between my freshman and sophomore year.
Oh, wow, yeah, late growth spurt.
Yeah, yeah, very late. And you know, as the listener doesn't know, I'm fairly tall now. And,
we're about the same height. I think you're a little taller than me.
Maybe.
Oh, you're, like, 6'2", probably, right?
I'm 6'3".
6'3", yeah, I'm 6'1", so.
There you go. But yeah, I was a very skinny, scrawny kid. But even when I was taller, I was really wiry and stuff. So, I think I eventually figured out. I mean, I'd figured out in middle school that I could stop people from beating me up if I made them laugh. And then in high school, I was like, I figured out that I could get attention. I could get girls' attention if I were funny, because I was like, that's what I had working for me.
Yeah.
And I had been body shamed enough throughout middle school to not have any self confidence in that regard. So. So I did improv, and then I started writing for The Broken Escalator my junior year of high school, and then they handed it over to me, because pretty much everyone was a senior, so they made me the head of it.
That's cool.
Yeah, which was my senior year. We really only put out 2 issues, but they're like 8 pages long each.
That's pretty long for
some of it holds up, some of it's really obvious inside referential, some of it's a little meaner than I'd like to be in my comedy now.
Yeah.
I think everyone... I don't know about everyone, but a lot of people go through that phase, which is like you learn to be, you craft your sense of humor by being harsh, and eventually I learned to be empathetic.
Yeah.
You know, I always wanted to like, you know, you're still like punching up for the most part, but like, you know, like being mean to people in power and things like that. But sometimes, you know, there's too much cruelty in it. So when I read some of that stuff, it kind of makes me cringe. And some of it's still very funny. But that was really where I learned, punch up. I mean, my friend David and I were like, well, I don't know how we do this, but we've got these drafts from people that aren't that funny, and then we would just go line by line and figure out how to make jokes out of the sentences that weren't jokes and things like that. And that's like the root of how I, you know, which is still one of my favorite parts of the writing process is, I mean, I really enjoy actually punching up other people's work sometimes more than writing my own. From it comes more naturally to me than... Because, you know, creating a framework is the hard part, I feel like. So
yeah.
Sometimes when there's a framework and you just get to write jokes, I love that. So that was how I learned to do that. And I was with a group of friends my senior year who were, like, the funny kids. And, the other thing was that we had TVs in every classroom. And the student union decided they wanted to do video announcements in our homerooms.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine knew that I was able to edit video, and he got me involved. And this happens with, like, every project I have, but it very rapidly went from a video announcement show to a sitcom about the people who are making the video announcement. And what we were essentially doing were, like, 5-minute video sketches twice a week. And, you know, we stopped going to class, and, like, we would skip class to shoot these videos. And this, like, we just became this video production group,
right.
Like, 7 or 10 of us. And we had to make 2 short films
a week,
yeah.
Which, that's a lot.
It was a lot.
I'm assuming Monday and Friday, probably?
I think maybe Tuesday and Thursday, or Monday and Wednesday. I don't know what it was, but it was twice a week. You know, we'd be staying up all night, not to do our homework, but to finish these videos. So, yeah, so, like, the second 2 years of high school, I was writing a lot of comedy, and I was making these comedic video shorts. I still hadn't tried stand-up, but I was with, like, a group of friends who were working on both of these things.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of overlap in those two crews.
Of course there is,
But, like, specifically, like, the humor magazine and the video crew.
Right.
And there's, like, this New York City high school tradition called Sing, which, like, every class puts on a musical, and, like, some of my friends and I wrote the musical for our senior year's group. So we were all, like, this kind of comedy crew. And we were like, all right, we're all going to, when we go to college, we're like, we're all starting to write, or some of us are trying to write stand-up,
right.
And we're like, we're all going to go to college, we're all going to try stand-up, and we were like, all right, great, we're going to go, we're going to do it, and I was the only one who did it, and all the rest of my friends dropped out of comedy.
So, like, it'd be funny, like, if they actually could have been, like, huge comedians also?
I mean, some of them were very funny, and still are. Like, one of my friends, you know, from that group is now a mathematics PhD. I think he chose the right direction, but and I have this email chain to this day where we submit to the New Yorker caption contest every week, and he's the guy who I did all the punch up with, so
right.
It's still the same kind of thing where we are just breaking jokes down to a formula and analyzing them like word by word, you know, punctuation, like, because, you know, you get one sentence, right?
So
it's this hyper-analytic, and he's a mathematician, so it's great, because...
So he's all about, like, the, like, where the pluses and minuses of the words are.
Well, it is funny. I had this joke, and I was like, I kind of want the opposite of this, and he found a way to phrase it, and I was like, I knew my mathematician friend would be able to invert the joke for me. But really what it means is, like, some comedians are like, oh, if you break the joke down, it's going to destroy it. And I've never felt that way. I've always been, like, an analytical person. So what's great with him is, like, he's this really naturally funny guy, and but he's in no way afraid of hyper-analysis. He's a mathematician. So he's perfect to do this.
I might have to, like, hire you to help me with my play for The Fringe if it gets in The Fringe.
All right, I'm in.
Because there's some jokes in there where I feel like they could be a little bit funnier.
I'll punch them up for you.
Yeah. Although my director, John Rashad, probably would take offense that I didn't ask him first.
All right, well.
But I asked him to. So you went to where for college?
Emerson.
Emerson, oh, that's cool. What made you choose there?
I got in. I applied to a bunch of schools that were out of my, they were all reaches. And I think I was not really willing to admit that, like, the grade waiting at my school, you know, had I gone to an easier high school, I would have had higher grades. But,
right.
I was like a B plus student at Stuyvesant, which would have easily been an A student at another school. But, you know, I'm not making excuses for myself. The problem is, when you go apply to colleges, they don't go, oh, well, I don't know, you know, they don't care.
They're like, oh, yeah, he went to this magnet school.
Yeah, and they'll say, like, extracurriculars, that'll help you. It doesn't help you. You know, people make their extracurriculars.
Dude, I went to community college for 3 years, and I went to the University of Florida.
I should have gone. My dad tried really hard to convince me, and he was like, look, if you go to Brooklyn College, you save $100,000, and we can spend that money on video equipment, and you could make your own movies, and you could actually invest in that, you know. To go to Emerson, you're going to have to take out loans. And to me, I mean, the main thing is I just didn't understand what money was or how much money that was.
I don't think I'm ever going to fully understand money, honestly.
And, well, being poor on my own has definitely made me understand it better. But at the time, it was too abstract. And I think the other thing was it just felt like a consolation prize, and I felt like that about too many things in my life, and I just wanted to go to what I thought was a real college. The problem is that Emerson is very expensive and is actually kind of academically weak. What I should have done now, in retrospect, I would have had to live at home if I went to a Brooklyn college or something like that, which I was more than done with.
As any 18-year-old is.
Yeah, exactly. No worse than other people's situations, probably, but yeah, I was 17 and I was ready to get the hell out of there. But what I should have done, I now realize, was like go to a state school for 2 years and then transfer in. Because the 400 and 500 level classes at Emerson were very good, and you were working with some teaching artists who were experimental filmmakers and doing interesting work.
And you went there for film, or?
Film production major. But there's so much stupid gen ed classes. I mean, I remember taking writing classes where people would hand in essays that literally would have failed my freshman in high school writing classes. And I was like, why am I spending so much? And because I'm good at math, I was calculating down to the minute how much money I was spending on this, and I would just argue with teachers
all the time.
That would
make me so mad if I knew exactly how much it cost.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to transfer, but I didn't. And so, you know,
my schools were not expensive.
People say a lot of Emerson had a big comedy community, which is kind of what saved me.
Yeah, it does.
There's like tons of comedy troupes there, and they like to take credit for that. But what I always said then, and it's totally true. They give the comedy troops no support. The worst plays at our school went up in a beautiful theater, and the best comedy shows went up in the basement of the dorm that had like a crappy like stage made out of different parts shoved together and these horrible uncomfortable chairs and low-tech sound and everything. Yeah, and they gave no support to the comedy community. They offered one comedy writing class that was only good because there was this one semester where everyone who was good in comedy was like, we're all going to register for this class, and we all got into it.
Yeah.
And it was great, but the teacher wasn't like,
great.
Not great, and it was the community that was great. And the really funny thing is that all the people who were in the comedy troupe were basically people who were one way or another dissatisfied with their education and were looking for a creative outlet.
Oh, that's so great.
Emerson is always like, oh, this legacy of comedy. But, like, realistically, the comedians were the people who were like, hey, this is too easy, and this sucks, and it's not academically rigorous at all. And so, like, it was people who were looking for another outlet to make the best of their situation, for the most part.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were writing a lot, you were making a lot of films.
At Emerson?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wasn't really making comedic... I was doing comedic videos. Stuff I shot to film, I was never really willing to do a comedy. And I was always saying, like, I don't... You know, film costs a lot of money. I've never written a $2,000 comedy. Like, I could do something that has ideas and explores things because it's not like, this is the punchline, was the punchline worth it?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I necessarily agree with that reasoning now, but that was my reasoning at the time. I didn't want to make...
So we're making, like, really, like, black and white movies.
Well, we had to start with black and white, but then we would go into color. But no, I was making a lot of experimental stuff or nonverbal stuff or things that were non-narrative. And then, and then my
very standard film school, yeah.
Well, sort of. My thesis film was a documentary, too. So it was just, I was interested in making stuff that was more about, I don't know, posing questions and like, films that were... something that you could think about was the idea, rather than comedy shorts, which felt like you got the joke and then it was done. So I felt like that wasn't really worth spending all that money and working. You know, there's so much in film that you can choose about the process and how you create it and the precision of the aesthetic. And I was like, that would be wasted on if it's all about the dialogue or something like that. And, you know, obviously there's comedies that take advantage of the film form. I just didn't feel like I could make that at the time. So those worlds were really separate to me for a long time. But I started doing stand-up my freshman year. There's a shitty club on the same block as my school, actually. It's still there, the Vault.
That's a cool name for a club.
Well, yeah, it was like an old bank vault downstairs. I used to joke that it was about as funny as a bank. And you can see some pretty bad comedy there. But they had a, like, bring two of your friends, and I brought, like, five friends. But then, also, Emerson, one thing that was good is people would do, I don't know if they were open mics or, like, loosely booked comedy shows, but they would be in, like, a conference room or a class. Like, you could book out these spaces in the dorms or in a classroom building, and so there would be comedy nights. And so I after doing this one bringer thing, I realized I didn't have to do that, and I started doing just, like, rooms around my school and then other colleges, and then... eventually, there's a club in Harvard Square called the Comedy Studio, where it's a strange room. It's like a showcase room, so everyone's doing 5 to 7 minutes, maybe 10.
Yeah,
And there's like 10 comics a night, and a Wednesday or Thursday night there could be a real drag. But I will say, like, you know, I would not really be a stand-up comedian probably if it weren't for that club. And by the way, Friday and Saturday nights are great, but
they're great.
I wasn't getting booked on the weekends as much, at least not at first. But like Rick Jenkins, the guy who runs that club, you know, gave me a shot when no one else was going to book me.
That's
ever.
Amazing.
And he takes a lot of chances. That's the thing; he takes a lot of chances on people. So like I said, on a Thursday night, took chances on a bunch of people, and probably some of them were not good. But a lot of those chances do pay off eventually.
And like that scene, the comedy scene in Boston's always had a great legacy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is interesting though, is like in the early 2000s, like the wave had long since crashed. So there was this like comedy legacy in Boston, but there were like two or three clubs, like the clubs had all kind of, like Nick's Comedy Stop was a dance club after the comedy show ended. The Comedy Connection was in Faneuil Hall, so it was kind of this big tourist trap. The, you know, Steve Sweeney's had moved to the back of a restaurant. Like, all the... There was no more... Catch was long gone.
Right.
It was like this, like, comedy ghost town in a lot of ways, where everyone was always like, oh, these legends, but, like, there would be these Boston legends, and they'd be 20 years older than anyone else performing comedy in Boston, because there'd be college kids who would then leave the town. And then these guys who had gotten big as comedians in the 80s, so they still had, like, during the stand-up boom, so they still... were touring and they could support themselves out. And there's like no one really successful in between. So it's kind of a strange environment. But then again, like there are other places where you could be where there's nothing. So we had like I said, there's a showcase club. Yeah, it's on the third floor of a Chinese restaurant, but that's what they
really?
Had. Yep, a Hong Kong
restaurant. That's cool.
well, you can order Chinese food to your table, which is nice.
Must say that very interesting to perform with that noises and smells.
To this day, they have not gotten a quieter cash register, which is in the same room as the comedy club. So it'll be like the third to last comedian set, and it's just this like dee-dee-dee-dee, like adding machine sound going off in the background. Yeah, that's something they
can hear the occasional yelling to the kitchen.
Well, the kitchen's downstairs, but yes, there is still occasional like rustling and waiters talking and stuff. But you know, that's clubs for you anyway. So. But yeah, I mean, that's what they had to do to survive, and that was the place I ended up performing a lot, probably more than anywhere else in Boston.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So when did you start wearing the suit?
I owned a couple suits in high school, which I would wear at whatever occasions. I did like a speech and debate also in high school, so you know, we would dress up for tournaments. I remember they had a career day where you dressed as the career you wanted to be, and I wore a gray suit with a gray top hat, and I told everyone I wanted to be a captain of industry, like a robber baron.
Yeah.
And I was one of three people who dressed up that day, so it wasn't just like I was wearing a costume and everyone else was wearing a costume and mine was a little bit more outlandish, but it was like New York City public school kids in like jeans and hoodies, and I was wearing like a gray or maybe like a houndstooth suit and a all gray top hat, and then like two other people had dressed up as anything,
like a firefighter.
Yeah, but this was a common thing where I would just make a spectacle out of myself. I think that was like that was how I gained confidence.
I mean, you wear an amazing suit.
Thank you. Yeah, I since learned to tone it down to a little bit more of a classy situation. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't wear a suit all the time, but I do like to dress well when I perform. I remember I studied at UCV, and this is jumping forward a little bit. But I think it was Kevin Mullaney who I actually got to study under.
I used to be really early.
Yeah. This is around where so I'm doing stand-up in college, right? And that starts freshman year, and my buddy who I started doing stand-up with was in the improv troupe starting his freshman year, and he tried to get me to audition the next year, and I think I hesitated, and I was too scared about it, and I remember, like, the next day being like, are they over? I was like, oh, I would have done that. I should have done that. And I really regretted it, and I ended up auditioning my junior year and getting in, and that was a long-form improv troupe. Our school had multiple improv troupes, too, but this was the one long-form troupe. It was called This Is Pathetic. It was, you know, by the way, improv troupe names are almost always bad. I still maintain that's a good one. I've always enjoyed that.
I don't know. I mean, like, as a person that like writes plays and stuff like that, I feel like if you give yourself a bad thing like that, that like just sets you up for failure.
What? Oh.
Like, I mean, I wrote a play called Mistakes, which was a good play, but it was called Mistakes, and like people were like, why would you name a play Mistakes?
Huh, that's interesting. I always thought This Is Pathetic was self-effacing enough that like it got away from like comedy troupes that have clever or corny names. I'm always like, oh, these guys think they're so funny. Whereas like This Is Pathetic, like it's just being like, hey, here's a cry for help. Do you want to watch this? Like, I don't know. I always liked it. But anyway, I mean, there have been a lot of people. Laura Keitlinger was one of the founders. I think Anthony Clark. And then the second semester, David Cross was in it. Were like a sketch troupe back then. And David Cross, I've talked to him about this before. He hates Emerson. He left very quickly and
yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah, he is not a fan of being an alumni there. And again, they love to claim, like, oh, David Cross went here. Like, he went there for, like, two semesters, and he left because he hated it. So, you know, he hates being associated with it. But he was in This Is Pathetic, a fun fact I get to say. So I started doing it then, and I think the summer after my junior year, Pat, the guy who I was doing stand-up with, who also had me do the improv audition, he and I he came and stayed with me. We were actually not staying at my house. We were living in someone else's house in Stuyvesant Town.
Okay.
For about 3 weeks, and we were just doing intensives at UCB. So that's when I actually started doing. We'd done workshops before because do like there's a college improv festival in Saratoga Springs. I forget which college that is. Skidmore College would have this big improv festival. So they would have UCB would come and do workshops there.
Right.
So we'd done workshops with our troupe, and we would go down as a troupe once a semester and take workshops at UCB and stay in New York City for a weekend. Done a bunch of workshops. Yeah, it was good. I remember we had one with Bobby Moynihan where he like taught us a new form. It was just like an all-day workshop, but it was, you know, we came away from it so much stronger. Like they, you know, you'd think that would be very brief and not that effective, but
I hear he was a great teacher. Never had the opportunity.
He just nudged us in the right direction in a way that like really worked. But so it was like 2006 that we started studying there, and I think we got there at a really good time because I got to study with Chris Gethard, Curtis Gwynn,
oh god,
Shannon O'Neill, I'm blanking. Zach Woods.
Oh, God.
Anthony King and Kevin Mullaney.
Oh, my God.
And then Bobby Moynihan after that. And then we did another workshop with Shannon and Chris.
Those are all, like, amazing teachers.
Yeah, and it was at a time when
and you most of them don't teach in New York anymore.
I know. And the thing is, I took classes for a while, and then I just stopped. Mostly because I graduated from college, and I ran out of money. And
right.
All of a sudden, it was like, oh, I have to pay for rent and stuff like that. And I do wish I had continued... I think there was something about the scene, too, where, like, everyone I knew was really obsessive and culty about it and, like, so into just, like, UCB was their whole life.
Yeah.
I guess if you move to New York and you're looking for a community to support you, that's awesome.
It's a really great community.
It just wasn't my thing. Like, I didn't want to be in... I always try to avoid being a part of any scenes because I feel like there's a lot of self-complimentary behavior there. And I think the UCB scene is a good one, and it's big enough now that it's multiple scenes, but...
Yeah.
Like, anytime there's, like, a group of stand-up comedians who all do the same shows and they all hang out, I'm like, these guys aren't fucking funny. Like, they all just laugh at each other's jokes because they have the same style.
Yeah.
And I'm always suspicious of scenes or movements because I feel like you don't grow if you don't have an outsider's perspective.
Of course.
So I think that was part of it. And then the other part of it was, like, I don't know, $400 to blow in a class. But I wish I had stuck around.
Well, back then it was, like, $300, but...
It was $300.
Because, like, I know it was, like, $300 for a while when I started, and then, like, went $350, and then...
Yeah, and I realize now what an opportunity I had, because classes were cheaper, the requirements to get on a Harold team were so much lower.
Did you ever audition for Harold teams?
No, never did, but I was probably, like, a class or two out from having to do that.
Yeah.
Now you have to do so much more, and more frequently, and more recently.
Yeah, I mean, I got very lucky, because I, like, actually, would have not been able to audition this year if I didn't get into the play at... in October.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really cool. I mean, Harold auditions also sound terrifying. So,
and the newest way it's going, it sounds like it's going to give me a full-on anxiety attack.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much more intense than it was. Oh, yeah.
It's so weird, because I mean, I've gone on a lot of auditions as an actor, and, like, don't feel that nervous. Like, I'm like, yeah, whatever, I'm just going to do my thing. Like, Harold auditions, they get me nervous, man. Like, because, like, my style of improv is very different than other people. Oh, God.
No way.
Oh, wow, the guest. The next guest is here already.
I know you don't edit, but can you?
I'm going to leave this in. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to let them in yet. I told them 3 o'clock. but we can continue talking while I should message her very fast.
Should we let her out?
Huh?
You sure you don't want to pause?
I'm gonna pause for one.
Pick up if you want.
And the pause is over, guys. Yeah, there is some crazy fun stuff, and we are back with Nat.
Right. Okay. So yeah, where were we? I was just saying that I kind of wish I had stuck and taken a couple more levels because
yeah.
I hear people talking about, you know, people who are now established or on weekend teams at the theater, and I don't know that that's really the life that I wanted of, like, going to Harold Night every Tuesday or like, being... Because when you're on, like, a house team, that really can be your whole life. Like, you have with those people all the time, and they might not be your friends. You're forced to be together with them, and, I'm probably
and
happier...
And that happens.
Yeah, and I'm probably happier taking the path that I took, but I hear stuff about, when Gethard was teaching, he was teaching all these, like, experimental classes, like the Raw Harold class. I don't know if you've heard about that.
I heard about that.
Yeah, like, I wish I had taken that, and that's not going to happen again.
You know?
I mean, there are other people doing interesting stuff. I think Atamanik's doing some really interesting classes right now.
Dressful's doing some really cool things, too.
Yeah, and so, like, it's not like there isn't interesting stuff going on, but I do hear about stuff that I missed out on, and I had all these great teachers. You know, I wish I had kept working with some of them. And I distinctly, you know, some of the people were like, you know, it was funny how you know, accessible and welcoming these people. I remember Zach Woods, who was like so, it's so funny how socially awkward he is because he's such a, like, confident performer. But
yeah, I heard he's really socially awkward.
Well, I remember
met him briefly once.
Yeah, once Pat and I studied under him afterwards. He was like, guys, that was really fun. And then we're like, gonna say goodbye. And he was like, let's, and there was a long pause. And he was like, be friends.
Oh, no.
Sure, Zach. And I actually didn't see him for years. I ran into him at Veselka in the Lower East Side like about a year or like a couple of years ago and got back in touch because he'd moved to L.A. and then also become extremely successful.
Yeah.
But also, like, you know, Curtis Gwynn was so immediately, you know, I think we'd studied with him for 1 week and he was like, oh, dude, I'm having this party at my house this weekend. You guys got to come. And, you know, like, you know, just.
That's cool.
Yeah, he was immediately
welcoming.
He seemed
like a cool guy, and then briefly at the last Ruru show, so.
Yeah, I, you know, he's a That show was insane, by the way.
That was one of the best experiences of my entire life.
Yeah, I went to both. He is such a bizarre performer.
I was so happy finally to see him, man. Like, because like, he was like out from New York by the time I moved. Like,
yeah, I used to watch him all the time. He was on Nights of Our Lives every month. Right. And then we used to watch Ruru all the time. And he's one of my favorite improvisers to watch. He's such a strange, singular performer, but he's so good. I remember talking to my brother, because my brother and I used to go see Curtis perform all the time, and we both went to the last two Ruru shows. And was his voice always like that, or did it get stranger since, like, or did we forget? but he's got this, like, intensity to him, and I think he saw a thing in me where I was, like, this sort of, like, over-anxious nerd, and he like, really identified with that. And he and Gethard both, I mean, they were, like, yin and yang. I was studying with them at the same time, and they were both really welcoming to me, and I think, like, really, like, you know, treated me like an equal. But also, you know, I had that arrogance in me. Like, I thought I'm, like, real smart, I'm real funny, and they would just knock that out of me. Like, if I would ever, like, wink to the audience in a scene, not literally, but, you know, like, if I would ever, like, cut my scene partner down because I knew they made a mistake. I remember I did that once where someone made a mistake, and I was like, I glanced together. He stopped the scene and was like, don't do that. And, like, wouldn't, and, you know, he really came down on me.
I've been to the top by Gethard briefly once because he did a workshop, like, a few months ago, and I was lucky enough to be in it. Got in my head, and he's a friend of mine, and I got, like, straight up in my head.
He was harsh on me sometimes, but I totally needed it. And then, you know, he was another person who just, you know, we stayed in touch after that for a long time. You know, we'd see him whenever we'd come down to New York. And then when I finally did move down to New York, I started seeing him again. But he was, like, a fantastic teacher to have, too. Both of them were.
How'd you get your show? Like, the Nat Townsend Downtown Variety Hour.
So there's a big gap there, which is, I came back to New York, and a bunch of my friends had this show at a theater in Boston, and they moved it down to New York, and they were doing it at the Pit, and they're all really excited about this show. And I remember visiting, like, in the winter break in my senior year, and they were all this great comedy community. And, like, I'd lost all these people who had graduated the year before me, who I performed with, and then they were all here. Like, a bunch of them were in New York already, and they were like, let's, you know, we're doing this show, and come down here, come do comedy. And somehow it had petered out, and over the next semester, or for me, semester, for them, a few months of life, I moved back to New York the day after their last show of their run at the Pit. And I was like, all right, guys, here I am. Who wants to do comedy? My 10 friends who all moved to New York, the city where I am from, and invited, tried to convince me to come back so we could all do comedy together. And they were all just like, no, man, I don't.
Oh.
And it was this thing where, like, I had expected to, like, hit the ground running. And I was like, I've been doing my show in Boston, and I'm ready to start doing shows here. And no one wanted to do it. And so the summer before, Joe Mandy had been in New York, and he and I had been going to, like, open mics, and we didn't know anything. Like,
another Emerson person, right?
Yeah. He's a couple years older than me, but while I was studying at UCB, he was living here, and he later did a one-man show about it, and, like, his living situation was destitute. It was terrible. I was like, Joe, you could have just crashed on my couch or something. Like, meanwhile, Pat and I were living in this nice apartment, and Joe's staying with this terrifying man out in Queens who smokes PCP. And I was like, Joe, you could have, like, we were hanging out with him all the time. He'd come over to our house.
Yeah.
Like, I remember we'd hang out on my roof, and, like, at no point did he mention quite how bad it had gotten.
Jesus.
But, anyway, he and I had been going to all these open mics, and so I kind of just, like, all right, what do I still know about open mics? And started, because I was still doing stand-up, too.
Yeah.
And I kept trying to get an improv group together. A couple friends of mine, I was trying to do this three-person improv troupe, and we would meet and workshop stand-up jokes and then do improv. And I don't know, they would be into it, and then they wouldn't be into it. And I felt like I was the only one who was really always into it. And it wasn't that I didn't want to do improv, but I just didn't have people to perform with, really.
Yeah.
And I didn't have money for classes. So I ended up just focusing on stand-up. And I had this desk job that I hated, and I used to have this other job where I would get to fly overseas to developing nations and teach, and that was a great job. And at one point I was gone for 5 weeks, and in the middle of that I was like, I know that I can't go back to doing my desk job. It was so soulless, and I hated it, and I was like, I can't. I was supposed to be like a video producer for this publishing company, but they really weren't even letting me make videos for the most part.
Oh,
I had to buy all this equipment, and then I would use shittier equipment for some reason.
Oh.
And I was, you know, doing this really stimulating, like, teaching, and teaching people to perform, and teaching people to make video and photography abroad, and, you know, teaching citizen journalists and stuff. And it's just, I couldn't go back. I that was when I realized, like, this just wasn't the thing for me. And I remember, like, my friends at, in that job being like, are you going to go back to that job? And then it became like, are you going to have that job when you get back? Because they started emailing me, and when I came back, they fired me. So it was, at the time, I was devastated. I don't know why. I hated the job, but it was embarrassing.
Right, yeah. I mean, anytime you get fired from a job, it's bad.
Yeah, so that happened, but the real thing that came out of that was this was right when the economic downturn happened, so I couldn't get a job after that.
Yeah.
And unemployment, the benefits were higher than they'd ever been. Obama had added to the
unemployment benefits. Right, after that, yeah.
So I got the most unemployment you could possibly get, which was a lot of money, and I think it was like $425 a week.
That's,
and I couldn't get a job. Money. So it was like this long period of time where my other totally poor, I had been the one friend who had money because I had this desk job,
yeah,
salary. My other friends were all like PAs, but we were all, you know, just hanging out in living rooms because we had no money or nowhere to go. And, you know, drinking whatever the cheapest can of beer was. And we created this show called The Moon, out in Williamsburg. And it ran for 5 years. It was the first 3 years, it was every 2 weeks, and then we made it monthly. But it was essentially a variety show, kind of like an old TV variety, yeah, show, where there would be a storyline that would tie it together, but then there would be guests interspersed. So it would be about an 45 minutes, I hesitate to say sketch because it's more like a play, but it right, the tone of sketch comedy. But we had recurring characters. We were always the same people, or often the same people. The host and I were always the same people. And we would do these, like, you know, it originally started with just, oh, there'd be a theme, and then, you know, within a couple of months, it became, you know, much like the video homeroom thing, it had become this story about the people in the,
yeah,
show.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of a show. The whole point was, like, every episode we'd try to do a show, and then something else would happen. Something would ruin it. Someone would, you know, it was always like, we're just trying to have a show.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And we would have, there'd be some hubris, and then we would get our comeuppance for it. And we ran that show for 5 years, starting at Royal Oak, which is a much beloved, now gone dive bar in Williamsburg, which is now in a nicer, in quotes, part of Williamsburg because there's condos and stuff around it. But at the time, it was just surrounded by construction sites, and you had to cross under the highway to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
But we could do anything there because no one was paying attention. There were no security cameras. At first, they were like, all right, no music. And then they're, no amplified music. And well, okay, you can have an amplified, but no louder than an acute. You know, cut to a few minutes in, we're having full bands in there. I like, teenagers coming to the show, people are smoking weed in the bar. Like, it was a crazy free-for-all back then.
Nice.
We were drinking for free, and, like, we had no money, but we put all our effort into this show. And we did it there for 3 years and then moved to Union Pool in Williamsburg. We did a few at other venues, too. And we actually did one. We started doing these, like, quarterly or twice-a-year specials at other theaters, and we did one at UCB East. When UCB East was really just starting. And
back in, like, 2011-12?
Yeah, yeah. It was like that in November of 2011, I guess. I think it was. And The Moon, you know, it was a ton of people from Emerson for the most part. And slowly but surely, either people moved away or started on their own endeavors. And at some point, we basically have said we were on a hiatus for the past year. We may do another show at some point, but it's pretty much over at this point. At the beginning of the fourth year, I decided that, you know, I had started this show so I'd have a place to perform, but I was no longer actually doing stand-up or anything that I could carry anywhere else at The Moon,
yeah,
because I was playing a character the whole time.
Right.
I was hosting, and it was, again, it was great because I got to be, like, the head writer of this group of writers and do punch-up and work with a team and a group of people and create. We would always, we'd do a whole show, and then we'd throw it away and start a new show next week, and that was, you know, now I realize probably we should have held on to something and pitched it in places, but, like, it definitely taught me how to work creatively under the gun. But anyway, I wasn't doing stand-up at my own show or anything that I could
right,
carry anywhere else. So I wanted to start something else, so I went to Nate and I pitched. I just wanted to do, like, a weekly stand-up thing because Totally JK, Joe Mandy and Noah Garfield's
yeah,
show, had just left, but they had, at that point, already replaced them with I think it was Adam Conover and Emily Heller at the time, a
right,
different show. So, like, that slot's not available. Let's look at other stuff. And then right around then, that whole quote,
stand-up
quote-unquote
yeah,
controversy
yeah,
nonsense arose. which I don't really want to get into because it's so childish. But, yeah. So that sort of changed and delayed things, and I was going to have a weekday show, and then they said, well, do you want Monday or do you want Friday? And I was afraid about Friday because they wanted me to fill the seats, more seats, but I eventually realized that Friday is easier to fill seats because people just go to UCB regardless of what's there on a Friday. So I did it. They gave me the Friday at 8 o'clock slot, and I sold out the first show, and then they just did it ongoing. And eventually they needed to make a weekend spot for Bucky, so they asked me to move to Mondays. I was like, well, am I doing anything wrong? And they're like, oh, no, not at all. I'm doing great, which is almost worse than being told.
But
like,
Mondays are like really a hopping day there.
It's kind of surprising.
Because like Improv Nerds brings a good crowd.
Yeah, I mean, we went from having a sold-out crowd to 35 people, or 20 people my first Monday show. Okay. So it took a while to build the audience back up, but now we've been...
And it's a 100-seat theater, so 20 people in that theater is not
117-seat theater.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, 20 does not feel like a lot. But now we're getting, you know, at least 70 or 80 people a show.
Which is amazing.
We're not doing more. Yeah, for a Monday, it's great. And actually, I kind of like it now because more regular audience members come. Friday, you get a lot of just people who are drinking or hanging out. They weren't drunk yet, usually, but they were drinking and they were going out to party. And my show has, like, an educational aspect to it. It has, like, an activism aspect to it. So on a Monday, I have an easier time getting people to be patient and listen. And also, like, with call to action, they'd be like, all right, so you're going to get up tomorrow and you're going to call your senator about this thing, or you're going to sign a petition, or you're going to donate money to help this bookstore stay
alive.
Exactly,
yeah.
And so, yeah, Monday feels more like a fresh start for that show. So,
which is why it's like Nerds work so well on Monday also, because, like, their week started with, like, watching some good improv and doing a good jam.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. It was a really funny moment with them. Brandon and Chelsea came to my show one time. You know, we're on the same night. They're like, oh, we've been meaning to come. We came early, so we wanted to watch. And I was bringing a guest on stage. And I was like, we took UCB classes together. We were in 101 together back in. And I was struggling to remember the year. And Chelsea goes, 2006. And I don't know her, but she was right. And I was like, damn, these people are improv nerds. Like, they know so much about improv that they know when I took 101. Like,
that's insane.
Yeah, that was really funny. And somehow, through connection, I took it with him. They knew when he had started. Like, they knew. But I couldn't remember what year I had started classes at UCB, and they could. I thought that was really
funny. That's so
funny. Yeah.
Getting ready to wrap up.
Sure.
I was, because, like, this is... fucking incredible. I could talk to you for like 8 more hours, but I literally don't have the time today because it's...
No one would listen to that.
No.
I'm not that entertaining.
I don't know. Oddly enough, some of our longer episodes are very, very popular.
I listen to the full Connor Ratliff episode.
He said the
same thing at the end. He's like, if anyone's still listening to
that. That was also the longest episode at that time. Mm-hmm. Like right now, we're at 72 minutes, so, which is fine. It's going to end up being like 78 minutes.
I think Connor and I share similarly obsessive personalities.
So do I.
We're not aware that we're talking for that as long as
honestly,
we are.
Honestly, I'm in that same boat as a person, too.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. What's something about Nat Towson people might not know that you're okay sharing?
Something about me that people might not know that I'm okay sharing? That's a good question. I used to be a singer long before I was a comedian. I sang
at CBGB, right?
yeah,
just like
no, I was like a choral singer. I sang with like the Boston Symphony Orchestra when I was a kid. I performed at Carnegie Hall with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. I sang backup on a Peter, Paul, and Mary album.
What?
Yeah, I played Lincoln Center with them and. A little bit more conflicting of a story now, but Cosby was on stage with us at one point.
Okay.
So I had this like whole like career as a child singer, and then I like hit puberty and just stopped because I was having a hard time transitioning to a different register.
Yeah, I thought I could sing, but I never was able to. But I love karaoke, so...
I still do sing karaoke sometimes. I like singing, and I found when we would do The Moon, we would do a yearly musical theater review where we'd all do sort of comedic takes on songs, but like all of a sudden it was like, oh, we're all actually kind of closet musical theater nerds, and like we all would have a really good time doing that. So, you know, I'd do a few different musical numbers there, or we would do, we did a Hootenanny show where we sang sort of like Americana Harvest season songs. The last show we ever did with The Moon was like The Moon Croons the Songs of Solstice, and it was all like winter and Christmas, but just sort of like holiday themed songs and stuff.
That's cool.
So yeah, I sort of would find ways to work it back in because I missed it.
That's so fucking cool. Oh my god, that's awesome. I love it. That's a really fun fact.
Nice.
Okay, so what about shows and things they have coming up that feel... Well, things that you're interested in. I just got the order wrong. So what's something you're looking forward to coming up that does not involve you?
Not me. Yeah. Let me see. I actually have like a thing on my phone about this. Let's see. Okay, here's a couple things. This one's slightly self-interested. Justin Tyler and Michael Hartney have a web series coming out for IFC
That
is called
great.
Unique New York, and it's all them doing characters. And I say it's slightly self-interested because I'm in it, but so briefly. I'm in like two sketches. But I think it's going to be really funny. I watched them shoot a lot of it, and a lot of UCB people are in it.
Great.
So Unique New York, I don't know when it comes to IFC. .com, but definitely check that out. I think it's going to be funny. I don't know. I'm looking forward to Colbert's Late Show. I'm really excited
to see
what that's
like.
I hope he keeps the beard.
I hope he does.
What'd you say?
I hope he keeps the beard.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm really excited to see what that is. He said a really interesting thing about, you know, someone asked if he was going to keep the character, and he's like, am I going to be a cable talk neocon on one of the biggest late night franchises? No, I'm not going to do that. And they were like, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I guess we'll all find out how much of the character is the real me. And I love that, because that is really what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
And he's such a huge influence on me that, I watched him obsessively in college when I was kind of love Strangers with Candy. Colbert Report, I just watched so much of, and really aped his style. I had to do this voice work one time where I had to do impressions of Colbert, of Peter Cetera, and Andy Warhol. And
oh my
I was
God.
Able to do Peter Cetera and Andy Warhol, and I couldn't get the Colbert down, and I realized it was because while I was figuring out sort of my stand-up voice, I had just stolen his style so much that it's too ingrained. Like, I'm not saying, like, oh, I'm like Stephen Colbert. I'm saying, no, I deliberately or non-deliberately stole from him to the point where I couldn't hear what was different enough to do a good impression.
Yeah.
It's ingrained in there somehow. Because, like I said, I stole it from him. I'm not taking credit in any ways. But anyway, I'm really excited to see what he does with The Tonight Show.
Nice.
And,
Late Show.
I'm sorry, yes, with Late Show. And, if you listen to this on Monday, Neil Casey's going to be in town, and he and Anthony are doing a two-man movie at UCB Chelsea in like a couple of weeks, I think. And if you haven't seen that before, that's always great.
It's fantastic.
You can see that. And yeah, and they might do that at DCM. You know, I would recommend to anyone who's really into seeing good and interesting improv to go to the non-wristband shows at DCM. Like if you can see, I don't know if the Swarm is going to perform again or if those days are over, but... if you can shell out the $10 to $20 to see John and Scott, which is a John Lutz and Scott Adson.
Gravid Water.
I think Christina Gaussis and Ellie Kemper are going to be doing
which
their...
Which is great.
That's one of the best shows I've ever seen. Christina Gaussis and Scott Adson used to perform together.
That was one of the first shows I ever saw at UCB.
I love that show. There's so much more, I don't know, patient and precise improv that you can see...
Yeah.
It's not that I don't like the house teams, but sometimes these groups of like 2 to 4 people are the best shows. And so if you can see, if you can afford, I understand sometimes the tickets are too expensive, but if you can get tickets to some of the like the satellite shows at DCM this year, I definitely recommend that.
Cool. What about plugs for you?
Sure. Oh, also, sorry, wait, one more thing. If you haven't seen it while it's still in theaters, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is
amazing. It's not going anywhere, though.
I don't think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to win, like, every Tony.
You can get... the back row is, like, $27, which is kind of a lot, but it's, like, better than any comedy show I saw last year.
And I was, like, 5 rows from the back.
Yeah. I don't want to say don't go to UCB, but you could see 3 weekend shows at UCB. Skip those and go see Curious Incident. It's a production from London's National Theatre. Based on a great book, but it's interpreted in a way... The National Theatre does a lot of stuff where the set and the production is very a huge part of the storytelling. It's not sparse at all. It's integrated, and that sounds like it could be gimmicky, but I've gotten to see a lot of productions actually at the National Theatre. I've been really lucky to go anytime I'm in London. I go and get the cheap tickets like day of, that kind of thing, but I've seen a lot of amazing productions there, and they integrate set design and production design and art design in a way that does not feel at all gimmicky. It feels like you're watching something enhanced. And it really changed my... Seeing shows there really changed my mind about, like, how the relevance of theater and how, inclusive theater can be and how much of an, like, enveloping experience it can be. And it's very rare that you get to see their productions in New York or in America. So if you are in New York, definitely see Curious Incident, because that is a national theater production that is just... scalpeled out and moved to,
Then they got a really great British actor who's actually from, went to Juilliard.
Oh, yeah,
The kid, and he's incredible.
Yeah, he's very good. It's a feat to perform that play, too. There's so much choreography,
especially in Act Two.
And it's a small cast, too.
It's like 10 people, I think.
Okay, so if you're listening to this, go see Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
And plugs for you, Twitter, Tumblr, shows.
You can follow me Twitter at Nat Towson, Towson's T-O-W-S-E-N, unconventional spelling. And I usually plug shows there. It's coming out when, Monday?
Yeah, so in 3 weeks, the next of... the Downtown Variety Hour.
Yeah. So the first Monday of every month, that's my main plug at UCB East, Nat Towson's Downtown Variety Hour. It is a local culture and history variety show. My girlfriend told me not to say it's educational anymore because she thinks that sounds too dry, but I'm being a stick in the mud, and I say it is educational, but in a way that's fun and interesting, and you can be drinking and still learn something. And I have a lot of great guests from the neighborhood. And
last week, he had Gene Garofalo. Awesome.
Yeah, and Cypher Sounds came on. We've been doing this series called The History of Hip Hop, so that was part two, and he's going to come back for part three. And it's like we play songs, we show pictures, we talk about it, and it's like.
Just and fans of the show will know that Cypher Sounds is a big historian on that type of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a DJ for Hot 97 for a very long time. And yeah, so that's the first Monday of every month at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater East Village, as it is now known. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, if you're listening to this on Monday, this Wednesday, I'll be doing a show at Carmine Street Comics, which is on Carmine Street, which is called Multiversity. It's a really fun show where the comedians write set lists and then trade them, and you have to do someone else's sets without knowing their jokes. So you just have to take their topics improvise a set. And I love improvising stand-up, so that should be fun. And then if you're in Boston... this coming weekend, come see me at the Comedy Studio. I'll be there all weekend.
Nice. Yeah. All right, my plugs quickly at MarkLevy85's Twitter. The only plug for this week that I can think of right now is the Dundee show that Fallen Socks is doing on the 12th at like 9 p.m., I think it is. Come out to see it. It's going to be great. And, of course, I think by the time this airs, the lineup will be announced for the longest improv set. At Trios, come see it April 5th, Easter Sunday, from noon to midnight. $10 all day tickets, which is a great deal.
Cool.
$5 per hour if you want to do it otherwise. I'd say just get a $10 ticket and just stay as long as you want. It'll be weird. It might be painful, but it'll be fun. Nat, this has been so much fun, dude. Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This was fun.
And I'll see you guys next time I hit the mark. Bye!